Hey, Uplifters. I want to take a minute to talk about something personal to me. In my 40s, I started noticing my hair was shedding more. So a couple of months ago, I started using Nutrafol. I'm already seeing so much less shedding. And my teenage daughter, who notices absolutely everything, keeps commenting on how thick my hair looks. As someone who's built my career around rigorous science, I super love that Nutrafol was the first brand to clinically study hair thinning on menopausal women, which is why I am so proud to have them as a sponsor. Nutrafol takes a whole body approach to hair health, supporting you throughout your life stages. You can see thicker, stronger, faster growing hair with less shedding in just 3 to 6 months. For a limited time, Nutrafol is offering our listeners $10 off your first month subscription and free shipping when you go to Nutrafol.com and enter the promo code Uplifters. Welcome to the Uplifters podcast, where every week we talk to inspiring women who have done big, brave things, whatever that means in their life, and try to understand how they do them despite having the same fears and worries that we all have. This week, I am so excited to kick off our long anticipated late bloomers series with Sari Botten, who arguably wrote the book on it. Well, at least a memoir in essays. It's called And You May Find Yourself, Confessions of a Late Blooming Gen X Weirdo. All words I love and relate to. And it made me really want to read it because I was like, I want to know a late blooming Gen X weirdo. I want to find myself in these pages and in these identities and maybe see some connections in there. Sari also edited 2 best-selling anthologies on Loving and Leaving New York, something I also relate to, having loved it for 25 years and now left it sort of down the street. And she publishes Oldster Magazine, which I have loved and read for years and am just so grateful is in the world. She also publishes Memoir Land and Adventures in Journalism. And I did this survey about what people want to talk about on the Uplifters, because there's Uplifters all around us and there's so many things we could talk about. But if we were to do a series, here are some ideas. And I did a poll with our audience and all the places, and it wasn't even close. What people wanted to talk about was late blooming, probably because we all see ourselves as late bloomers. I was surprised, though, to see that the people who responded first and loudest were in their 20s and 30s. And I was like, girl, you can't be late. And then I was like, no, it's all of us at every age that sees ourselves in that way. When I started to ask my friends who I should talk to about late blooming, my dear friend, the author, Carla Zanoni, immediately said, well, obviously, sorry. And I was like, oh, do you think she'd really talk to us? Because I'm such a fangirl here. And she said, yes. And so today I get to talk to Sari and you get to hear from Sari. And I'm just pretty stoked about the whole thing. So Sari, that was a really long introduction, but I'm really glad you're here.
Thank you. I'm so happy to be here.
If we're going to talk about late blooming, we have to start with what that even means.
I think that Gen Xers in particular have a tendency toward late blooming. And I think part of it is because our childhoods were disrupted by the sexual revolution. Our parents changed dramatically in the 70s. They went from being like the parents in the Dick and Jane books, very formal, very formally dressed, never swore, to all of a sudden they were disco ducks and every other word out of their mouth was a swear word and they were reinventing themselves. And it was a very confusing way to learn about adulthood and what it means and what you're supposed to do. Not that I really believe in supposed tos, but which is also very Gen X of me, by the way.
Amen.
But I think that Gen X in particular is very confused about how to be grown up. And so a lot of us have these sort of protracted adolescences, which I think I'm still having at 2 months before 60. I don't really know how to be a grown up. And other than to like pay my mortgage and do my work, there's so much that just feels like I'm not doing it at the right time. I also think that getting older freaks everyone out at every stage of life, because we're always the oldest we've ever been. You've never been 30 before you've been 30. And so you're watching the numbers, you're watching older people, and you're passing this threshold that is new to you. And so every age feels old and scary and exciting and daunting. It's such a weird thing getting older. So I don't think anybody of any generation is really clear on what they're supposed to be doing when, unless they're like real hardcore rule followers. And those people exist, obviously. But I think it's very common for people to feel like they're not on target. They're not step with their peers, with their milestones. But I think it's particularly true for Gen X.
I am also Gen X. I think at any age group, we hear these same questions of, am I too late? When I talk to my boomer friends, they're worried about being too late. I talk to my Gen Alpha friends. Having teenagers means that I get to have Gen Alpha friends. And it's pretty fun. And I hear from them this fear that they're too late. A big piece of your memoir, which I so enjoyed reading, the big question in all of those essays, how do we get to be an adult? Who is an adult? How do we find ourselves and stop reshaping ourselves to everyone else's expectations? And so where are you with that now? Having interviewed hundreds of people for Oldster, having gotten to 2 months before 60.
Well, I'm in a lot of places with it all. First of all, I want to add something to what we were just talking about, which is it's not only the things I said. Another factor is that we live in a youth-obsessed culture that is, you know, constantly promoting things like 30 under 30, 30 authors under 30 who to look at, 30 actors under 30, under 25. So the culture makes us feel like if we don't do certain things by certain times, we're done. We're cooked. So that's another factor that I keep seeing everywhere throughout different age groups on Oldster magazine. I still don't really know how to be an adult. And I think for me, some of it is that I skipped certain really significant milestones, the biggest of which is I didn't have kids, which means I don't have grandkids. And my peers have grandkids now, or they're starting to, or their kids are getting married. And so that has made me feel like I'm lagging behind my peers, not unhappily. I ultimately learned when I couldn't have children that I didn't want them. I like the life I have. I'm married. My husband and I are both kind of spiritually young for our age. We think of our house as like a big arts camp. We're both into creative things and we give each other a lot of space to pursue our creative pursuits. But I think I'm going to forever wonder how to feel my age and whether I should. It'll always be something that fascinates me, which is what makes my work with Oldster so gripping for me. I can never get enough of the Oldster questionnaires, no matter who's taking it. I'm so interested in people's perspectives on being exactly their age and where they're headed. Whether they're 48 or 98, you know, I'm really interested in people's experiences of being their age.
Have you noted in reading those responses to the questionnaire any themes amongst those people who seem to be most at peace with where they are and most accepting of the beauty of that moment?
Well, that seems to happen when people are older. Most of the people who say those things are at least over 50, some of them, you know, 60, 70. They have reached a point where they've stopped pretending to be who they thought they were supposed to be or people wanted them to be. They're either too tired from it or they've tried too many times to fit themselves into the wrong shaped hole. And it's very refreshing. It's very refreshing. Or they've achieved enough. There was one person who took it recently who said, I've achieved enough to feel like, okay, I'm fine where I am. And I've had enough failures to be humble. was Tommy Swerdlow. Yeah, something like that. So at a certain age, people have done enough things. They've had enough achievements. They've had enough failures to get a sense that, like, they don't have to do everything. They don't have to please everyone. There are certain things that are right for them and certain things that are not. And they stop caring about the things that are not for them.
And do you feel like you're there?
I don't know if I'll ever be there. I don't know. It's just, I'm very self-conscious. It's just, I've always been very self-conscious. And like, I have this anxiety that runs throughout my life about whether I'm doing the right thing at the right time. And it started for me when I was 10. My obsession with age and aging did not start in my 40s or 50s. It started when I was 10. And at my 10th birthday party at a bowling alley, my mother's brother, my uncle, arrived. And the first thing he said to me was, "Wow, you'll never be one digit again." And that one line just blew my little tween mind. Like, oh my God, there's a thing I can never be again. I am on a timeline that goes in one direction. I cannot, how many other things are there going to be that I can't turn around and do again? And which ones am I supposed to do when? And also, I was always out of step with my peers. I was doing things early and I was doing things late. I was the first reader in my kindergarten class. And I was the last developer in the gym locker room in junior high and high school. I didn't get my period till I was 18, but I was reading at 4 and a half, you know? So it was like, I was always like, what am I supposed to do when? These people don't do this yet. And those people do this already. And, you know, I'm an anxious person and I'll probably always be an anxious person. And that's good because it will keep me moving forward with this thing that I love to do.
Yeah, that's super interesting. And it makes me think too of some research I did years ago. We were trying to get people to do a behavior for a company. And we ran a bunch of different experiments to see what we could tell them that would get them to take action. And it turned out that the most effective thing we could do was to create a fear that if they didn't do it, something bad would happen. And so what we ended up doing was studying fear of regret, which ends up being a very powerful motivator for people, not long term, but in the short term, it's super effective. And I hear that a little bit in what gives you a sense of urgency is like, ooh, if I don't do this now, then I won't be able to. It took you 15 years to put your memoir into the world.
Yeah.
And so what got you over the hump from should I, could I, would I to doing?
The pandemic, first of all, I had quit my job early in the pandemic. There was some bad stuff going on and I was probably about to get fired anyway. I was a little bit of a whistleblower. I didn't realize how hard it was going to be to get another job at 54. Mm. And I encountered some ageism on the job front, but I had time and I had a book deal and it was like, okay, it's time to put up or shut up. So now you just got to do it. Still, every night in the middle of the night, I told myself I didn't have to because I was so anxious about it. But what really got me over the hump finally was something that's been in the back of my mind my entire life, which is that both of my grandmothers died in their 50s. And one died at 51 before I got to meet her. I'm named for her. And the other died at 55. When I was 6 and a half years old and I loved her very much. These tragedies really informed my childhood. Both of my parents were grieving their mothers and there was this looming specter of women die in my family in their 50s. Mm-hmm. And I was 54. And it was like, okay, am I gonna just let this opportunity pass? This opportunity I've wanted my whole life that has finally been given to me. If I don't do this now, who's to say I get the opportunity again? Mm-hmm. Who's to say if I cancel my book deal and say, no, I can't do this, that I'll ever get this chance again? It's like, you have this shot. You've asked for this shot. You've been given this shot. Go take it. And ultimately I did. I actually postponed the book by a year. I spent more time with it extracting details that would identify people. That was the number one anxiety around publishing my book, was revealing people who didn't want to be revealed, especially the people who did not act in ways that they might be proud of. And so I think I finally, in my last pass with the manuscript, figured out the way to handle. I blurred ex-boyfriends to the point that only they would recognize themselves. I dealt with my parents' behaviors by saying that it was the grown-ups around me, not just my parents. And when I really thought about it, that was true. Mm-hmm. It wasn't just my parents who were diet obsessed, body obsessed. It was my babysitters, my school teachers, my camp counselors, the teenagers in my neighborhood. So the more I worked on extracting details and making it more about phenomena in my world than about specific people, the better I felt about it and the less anxious I was about pulling the trigger on publishing it.
And what I hear there for a process point for anyone listening who's sort of sitting on something, it really is getting clear about what those fears are. And I did that with a client this morning who has been sitting on her Substack and hearing messages from other people who are in her life who are like, this is going to be too vulnerable. What if people in your life don't want you to tell your story? And all those little fears and stories, consciously or not, slow us down and leave us with that sense of longing. And I think the only way through them is to do what you did and what the client and I did this morning, which is to consciously extract each of those threads, hold a mirror up to them and say like, well, what is it about this one?
Yeah.
We talked about the difference between vulnerability versus like being under the gun, like putting yourself in a place where like, yeah, or I was like, are you going to commit fraud? Are you like breaking a law, right? Those are different than, oh, somebody might have feelings about my work, which is what we want. So I think that, and I imagine, I certainly feel it years into sharing my own story in different ways, I still get scared and I still find that hard. And so it's a continuous process, I imagine, for you as well.
It's always scary. It's always scary. First person writing is always scary. And if it's not, something's wrong. Or you're not doing it right. Like, you got to be willing to reveal a lot about yourself. You got to be willing to examine yourself in ways that might not be flattering and probably shouldn't be. You've got to take risks. You got to care about the reader too. You know, you can't just, you know, even though I extracted a lot of details, I feel like I still made important meaning of the experiences I share in the book. I made them relatable and entertaining, and they have meaning. I've interpreted my experiences. I haven't just transcribed them. But it is scary. It's scary to reveal yourself and to take risks and to also tell the truth, tell hard truths.
Mm-hmm. Well, and you really set that up in the opening of the book. You say, look, this is what I'm trying to do, and I'm a human doing it, and this is scary, and this is hard, and I've worried about what you're going to think of me if you read this. So just know, I am with you. And one of the things Carla said to me recently that I thought was so wise and valuable is she said, like, so much of what we worry about is other people having feelings about our work. But isn't that the point of putting art into the world, is to create feelings?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Also, it's admitting to feelings that are uncomfortable, that nobody talks about, but that everybody wants to hear somebody else thinks and feels. Mm-hmm. For me, that's why I became a reader of memoir. I wanted to read people like Anne Lamott writing about the painful and scary things that I was afraid to admit to myself and to other people. She was willing to admit them, and it made me feel less alone. And that's, like, as far as I'm concerned, that's the number one job of the memoirist, is to share things that other people are stuck feeling and stuck alone with, to let people know they're not the only ones. And you're going to be the brave person going out there and saying, hey, guess what? I lied to people about who I was because I wanted them to like me, and that sucked. And people then come forward and say, oh my God, I did that too. One of my best experiences with publishing my memoir was I got an email from a woman I hadn't seen in 20 years. We knew each other in the East Village, and she had what seemed to me a very happy marriage. And there's a piece in my book called Hurricane Tim that's about a really difficult relationship. But Tim wasn't the only problem. The bigger problem was me trying to, you know, see myself through the mirror of Tim. You know, Tim was outdoorsy and had a certain coolness to him that I wanted to see in myself. And so I just created this version of myself, outdoorsy Sari. It was ridiculous. And I put myself in situations with him that were really dangerous for me. Like I could have died on the tops of some of these mountains we were hiking. And my friend from 20 years ago wrote to me and she said, your essay helped me understand why I had to end my marriage. I couldn't have articulated it until I read that piece of your book. She said that she had put herself in similar situations with her husband, and A, it was dishonest of her, and B, he had no interest in hearing about when she said, this climb is too steep for me, my foot hurts, can we pause? And she didn't take that in, and she went and had built a whole life with this person who disregarded her feelings. And there's a dishonesty to not speaking up and saying, this doesn't work for me, you know, so we're complicit in that. We're not just victims. Whatever I was getting out of being with Tim, she was getting out of being with her husband, and then it stopped working and she had to reckon with it. So hearing from this woman, first of all, I hadn't known that their marriage ended. And second of all, hearing that sharing my experience helped her make sense of her own. That's the whole reason for me. Well, not the whole reason, but that is like the number one justification for memoir, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah. It lets us get some distance from our own stories. And you even say, I think it's at the beginning of that chapter, you're like, he had one plate, like should have been a red flag.
There were so many red flags.
But you can't see that when you're up close.
Yeah.
And it was only when you got some distance that you were like, why has he had zero interaction that like to share a plate with?
I worked very hard not to see those red flags. Another person would have been like, okay, here's a person with one plate. Let me go home now. You know, here's a person who deliberately has one plate in his cupboard.
That's not very inviting.
No, no. You know, this is an antisocial person. And I tried to change myself and I tried to change him. So that's, you know, that's my part of the wrongdoing.
I mean, I've already diagnosed him as a narcissist. Sorry.
Oh, yeah. Completely.
Yeah. I like don't even know him, but I've decided. And I think the other thing, though, that first person narrative storytelling does really powerfully is it is in stories, and I have a bias probably because I've spent my entire career in change. And I think it lets us, in hearing other stories, have hope and believe that things can change.
Yes.
And we get to see that in your story. But I also hear it because you talk about the stories you received about what a woman's lifespan was, how it influenced you. And it's very different than my stories. The stories I grew up on, all the women in my family lived until they were in their mid-90s, and they were doing big, brave things in their 70s and 80s. They were creating the change they wanted. So I have not felt that clock as acutely, because I'm like, 50? All right. We just got to the halfway point.
That's great.
Let's go. And that's just a radically different paradigm than the one you were growing up on.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. Just yesterday, I had the pleasure and honor of interviewing filmmaker Ava DuVernay for Oldster.
I saw that come out today. I can't wait to read it.
Yeah. And one of the things she talks about is how both her mom and Oprah got on health kicks at 70. And she said, like, the negative thing is that I'm thinking, and she's 52, she's going to be 53 later this month. She's like, I'm thinking, okay, good. I have till 70 to get started, because she's not exercising. She doesn't like exercise. And that assumes that she's going to live at least that long. Who the hell knows, you know? But it's interesting. She takes that to mean, okay, I've got another 17, 18 years before I need to start taking care of myself. But she also realizes, she says, that she should get in gear.
Yeah, I mean, it is interesting, isn't it? And especially with somebody like that who at sort of a later age really found her audience.
Yeah.
And so she is heavily investing in her creative work right now, in her legacy, as it were.
Yeah.
And so it's also a good reminder to me that, like, not every time is for everything. Yeah. Maybe when your career is on fire, it's going to be harder to find time to work out.
Yeah.
I mean, hopefully we can have it all, but also sometimes we just won't. We talked about a little the fact that you really were considerate about these blurring these other characters and showing respect to them. But I think that's just one part of sort of the permission question we all ask ourselves when we say, like, and you talk about this in the opening, you're like, well, my experiences are not like, I didn't have cancer 15 times. There's no trailblazing, earth-shattering, Sari Botten was the first woman in history to story there. It was stuff that lots of women experience. And you wanted to tell that story for all the women who experience it. And all of those, I think, play into our, you have the right to tell your story questions. And so I'm curious how you gave yourself the permission to do it.
Well, first I want to say that the best memoirs, for the most part, are not about exceptional experiences. The job of the memoirist is to illuminate the mundane. There is a whole segment of the memoir category that is people who have had exceptional experiences. And that is a valid portion of it, but it is not the meat and potatoes. You don't read those books to identify. And memoir is about identifying. And a memoirist is someone who is a good writer, who has a way of interpreting their mundane experiences in such a way that people can let themselves in and see themselves. And that happened with my friend that I mentioned that I hadn't seen in 20 years. So I explain that in the beginning of the book, because as someone who also publishes a magazine called Memoirland and has worked in memoir and personal essays for so long, I'm so used to the uninitiated who come in every now and then like, oh, so what? So what? That person just lived a normal life. Who cares? And I'm always defending it and saying, that's not what memoir is about. It's not about outrageous stories. It's about making sense of things we all have in common in ways that help us understand ourselves and our lives. So that's the first thing. The other thing in terms of permission, that was the hardest part for me and why I wrestled with this for 15 years and why I interviewed various memoirists for the Rumpus for years. What do you do? How do you do this? How do you tell the uncomfortable things about yourself in a way that isn't going to upset your family? How do you tell about them in a way that isn't going to get you disowned? This was the biggest challenge for me. And my friend Alyssa Altman has a great new book out about it called Permission, The New Memoirist and the Courage to Create. But I had experiences already with publishing personal essays in big places, Marie Claire, the New York Times, Modern Love. I published two of them. And in each case, I had to get over myself and just give myself permission. And in each case, hundreds of women contacted me and thanked me and said, very much like what my friend said to me, you told a version of my story that helped me feel seen, helped me understand it. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. And then that is what I kept in mind when I was struggling to give myself permission. And then at a certain point, I had to stop stalling. I said, I can't keep stalling like this. And as I said earlier, what's the chance I'll get this opportunity again? I just have to just give myself the permission. I know how this works. I know that there are going to be some people who are upset with me. There are going to be some people who belittle me. There are going to be some people for whom this book is just not for, and they're going to be jerks about it. That's just part of it. The bigger part is the people who identify. And there's a bit of a cult following to this book, which I did not anticipate, especially because I published with such a small publishing house, which was a blessing, honestly, because I don't think I could have handled a big splashy rollout. I've watched colleagues of mine struggle with that. One of them just talked at an event I went to about how her brother's not talking to her. Mm-hmm. Another talked about how her parents aren't talking to her. I think the fact that I published with a very small house, it had a very small, you know, it made a very small dent in the world. That gave me, it allowed me to both do it and not do it, you know? Mm. It allowed me to both publish my book and not really suffer the huge consequences of it. And so that made it a little bit less scary, but a lot of Gen X women with similar backgrounds, there's like a little bit of a cult around this book. And I am so moved by that. I feel so grateful for it.
Wow. That to me is such an interesting point you just made too about how you put it in the world. So there's the one thing of creating it. And I want to make sure we talk about the fact that you said you gave yourself permission to quit at any moment.
Mm-hmm. Every night, you don't have to do this. Let's just not do it. And then at 7:30 in the morning when I would get up, I said, of course I'm going to do this.
Right. And I think we need that, right? That like, you can just keep going for this moment. And I have to tell myself that every day. I'm like, it's okay. Do the big, brave thing. You can stop at any time. Because my brain does not remember that from day to day. I have to like consciously tell it that it's going to be okay. I can stop. The other thing though is like how we put the thing in the world. And so I do think for a lot of us, we end up feeling disappointment about what we've created because it doesn't find its people. And in a lot of cases, it's because we hid it. We were like, I'm going to put it in the world so I can say I did it, but I'm not really going to put it in the world because I'm not going to tell anybody I did it. And then I'm going to be like, why don't you like me? And you were saying that was my strategy, was to put it in the world, let it find its right people, put it at the altitude that suited me holistically, and do that consciously. So that's a really interesting balance to the, I'm going to put it in the world, but I'm going to hide it story.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, I didn't realize that until later. I was unable to get a Big Five deal. And at the time, I was upset about it. And then I found, then it was picked up. I got a book deal from Heliotrope, a very small publisher in the East Village, which is where I was the most me, where I lived for like 15 years. I loved meeting Naomi Rosenblatt, the editor and publisher. We went to Cafe Mogador and she basically sold my book to me. She basically told me why this book was so important. And I was so happy. I got two other offers from Tiny Presses and this was the right home. I realized it a little bit when we made the deal. And then really when the book came out, I was like, this feels right. And so it feels like it was meant to be in a way.
So this feels important to the whole late blooming concept too, because it is also, again, about time.
Yeah.
Right? Like we may not get what we want when we want it, but I think if we chase the feeling, right? If we think about like, I want to feel this way in the relationship with my publisher, we'll end up in the right place. As opposed to, I want the publisher who makes me feel like I'm important and special.
Really. And I also think now, when I look back, all the other times that I thought I was ready to write and publish this, I wasn't. I would not be happy with a version that I would have put out earlier. Those 15 years of incubating, they were crucial. They felt like torture. I felt like I was stalling. But the truth is, the versions I would have put out, I mean, based on also there are personal essays I regret putting out in the world that I put out at those times. I hadn't evolved enough as a writer, as someone in the memoir space. I hadn't fully evolved to the place I needed to be at to put out the right version of this book.
Wow. That's really comforting. as I sit with my own book proposal and go back to it. And I'm like, that wasn't very good, that opening. How did I submit that to somebody? I need to rework that piece.
Yeah.
And I think that's another one that, like, we just can't hear enough. The right thing in the right time and keep showing up for it.
Yeah. And also, like, realize,
because it's not going to happen by accident.
Right. You have to keep showing up for it. You have to keep moving toward it. But you also have to bear in mind that some of what you might need to do is grow up a little bit, evolve a little bit. An interesting thing that is about to happen is there's an essay in the book that I originally published another version of on ExoJane in 2012. ExoJane no longer exists. And I am really glad you can't see that version of the essay, because it's not right. It's sensationalized in ways. It's just not right. But anyway, I interviewed Jane Pratt, the publisher then of ExoJane, who is now putting out a Substack called Another Jane Pratt Thing. I interviewed her for Oldster, and she also took the Oldster questionnaire, and we're friends. And at one point she said to me, we talked in our interview about some of the pieces I published on ExoJane. And she had said to me, let me know if you ever want to, like, revive one of them for what I'm doing now. So a few weeks ago, I went to her and I said, you know, there's a version of one of my ExoJane pieces in my book. It's a very different version. I have a very different perspective. I make different meaning of it now. Would you want to reprint it? And so she is about to, with an intro from me and an intro from her about what changed between the versions. And I'm much happier with the current version, you know.
Yeah, I'd be super interested to see them side by side too, as a lesson in perspective.
Yeah.
And how we change. Yeah.
There's a particular art to knowing when your piece, when your book, when it's ready, when it, you know, people are in such a rush. And one of the things I always tell students is don't be in a rush. Don't be in a rush. I mean, I know you never know what's going to happen, but don't publish things that are half-baked. Take time with them, put them away, revisit them. You know, and it's hard to know when exactly is the right time, what is the right version. But if you're just rushing to get that, you know, achievement, I did this, I published a personal essay here, I published my book, just to have the accolade, just to call attention to yourself, then it's not right. You got to wait until you really, really know it's the right version and that you are the right version of yourself to put that out there, to be the author of this.
So I think of that filter as putting out work that I genuinely love. Do you have a more specific filter for that?
It's hard to know because there's always anxiety around putting stuff out there. It takes time. It's like you have to sit with things. I knew when my deadline for the book came and I handed it in and my editor gave me notes, I knew I wasn't ready to publish it. I needed another year. I needed more time to refine it and also blur it. And I'm so glad I listened to that instinct. Mm-hmm. I was so afraid to ask for that extra time. God, is she going to pull my book deal? But something deep in my gut knew it wasn't the right version. It wasn't. And I honored that instinct, and it was the right instinct. I now know.
Yeah. And isn't it a good metaphor for all aspects of our lives, whether it's relationships or our art or our self or even our homes, right? It's for everything, really listening to that inner voice and saying,
yeah,
like, I'm going to honor you and respect. I'm not going to let it be the only filter, but I'm going to listen and say,
yeah,
what is this really? Is it fear or is it truth?
Is it a valid message that this needs more time? It needs more time to cook.
Mm-hmm. One thing I feel like we have to touch on just so that we don't lose it for the history of the Sari Botten episode, is giving yourself the permission to write a draft that nobody would see.
Oh, yeah. I don't know why I hadn't thought of it sooner. Like, I was tiptoeing around. I got the book deal. And then I'm like, oh, why am I not writing it? Why am I not writing it? And a friend got, this is funny. A male friend got a book deal the same week that I did. And we both were like, yeah, we're getting up at 6 a.m. We're both going to get up. We're going to encourage each other. And I was like, if he's doing it, I can do it. And I'm like, why am I not doing it? Why am I not doing it? And then finally, it dawned on me Write the version nobody's going to see. Get it out of you. Get it out of your body, out of your head. Just write the version nobody's going to see. Because I was like, oh, can I tell this? Can I tell that? Can I tell it? No, you know, I was editing and writing at the same time. And that never works. And that was the best thing I did. I wrote the whole version that nobody was going to see. It was very different. And also there were more pieces to it. And I realized as I was working on it, which pieces no longer fit through the lens that I was applying to this. And the lens became clearer once I got it out of my body and out of my head. And I couldn't see it until I put it outside of me. The fun footnote to this is that that male friend still hasn't finished his book. And I give a lot of authority to men, and it's not good. I let this person be like the person who was telling me, get your book done. Meanwhile, this person has not finished his book. He has gotten so many extensions, and, you know, God bless him. And I hope his publisher keeps giving him extensions as long as he needs them. But my book is now out for a few years, and this person hasn't finished their book. And all the pressure I was putting on myself to do what the man is doing and what the man is telling you to do. Well, so much for that.
Yeah. So it took a lot of bravery to put your work in the world in this way. It took a lot of bravery to continue putting work into the world. I imagine you were a little nervous talking to Ava, even if like you're besties and you love each other. I mean, like, that's intimidating. It takes courage. What's the next big brave thing you're mustering courage to do?
My agent and I are working on a proposal for an oldster anthology, and I'm scared. I also, because I have a different concept for this book than my prior anthologies. It's a bigger concept. It's a lot more content. It's more scrapbooky, and I don't want to say too much about it. I don't want to talk it away. But of course, I have some trepidation also about the workload, because I already have too big a workload. How am I going to do this?
Yeah.
And the other thing is I'm creating my first live events for Oldster. And one of the things I am wrestling with myself about is, am I going to sing? I struggle with the courage to sing. I'm actually a good singer. As a kid, I had a talent agent that I was working with. Like, I can sing. And I'm always afraid of doing it. I always feel, how dare I call attention to myself with this? And there's a lot mixed, baked into that. My dad's a singer, blah, blah, blah. So I'm trying to find the courage to make this event happen and sing. So I think I'm going to do it, but I'm doing to myself that same thing I did with the memoir, which is every night at 3 in the morning, 4 in the morning, I'm like, I'm not going to do this. What? Of course I'm not going to do this. No, I don't have to do this. I'm going to take the pressure off myself. And then at 7:30 in the morning, when I'm up having coffee, I'm like, of course I'm going to do it. Why would I not do it? So that's the next frontier.
You found your recipe, I think. Give yourself permission not to at 3 a.m.
Exactly.
And that's then allow the yourself to keep going at 7 a.m.
Exactly. Yeah.
Well, I host an annual Uplifters Live event every March, and I really hope you'll come and sing.
Oh, yeah. Where is it?
At Caveat.
Oh, I love Caveat.
I love Caveat too.
Yeah. Sure.
All right. Done. It's a date.
Book me. Then I can't get out. Don't let me get out of it. Because I'll try.
I'm really good at holding people accountable. we're on. Who do you want to nominate for the Uplifters podcast?
Blair Glazer, who also has a memoir coming out from Heliotrope next year. She is someone who has reinvented herself many times. Her memoir is really, really great. She was in a cult at an ashram in her 20s. She has been a therapist. She's been a motivational speaker. She's had so many different ways of being her, showing up in the world professionally and personally. She's also a talented singer. So I nominate her.
I can't wait to meet her. So as uplifters, we like to uplift other uplifters. How can we best support you and your work now?
You can buy my memoir. You can buy it in print, or I've created the audio version recently.
which I listen to. And your voice is beautiful and your narration is beautiful. And I'm embarrassed that I still called you sorry because I heard you call yourself Sari like 20 times in the course of the book.
I'm so used to it. It's I don't even blink.
I get called Aransas all the time. Yeah. So yeah.
And you can also become a paid subscriber to one or more of my newsletters, which I put a great amount of work and care into. Oldster, Memoirland. Yeah, it would be great to have more subscribers.
Yeah, wonderful. You're doing great work in the world, and I'm super grateful that it exists.
Thank you.
In the time that I exist and that I get to benefit from all these beautiful stories, I really think stories hold so much power for us to feel seen and connected and safe and to stretch and grow. So thanks for sharing yours today.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to the Uplifters podcast. If you're getting a boost from these episodes, please share them with the Uplifters in your life and then join us in conversation over at theuplifterspodcast.com. Head over to Spotify, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcast and like, follow, and rate our show. It'll really help us connect with more Uplifters. And it'll ensure you never miss one of these beautiful stories. Mwah! Big love.
Painted water sunshine with rosemary and thyme. Dwell in the perplexing, though you find it vexing. Toss a star and hover, be your own best lover. Relish in a new prime, plant a tree in springtime. Dance with idle hindsight, bring the sun to twilight. Lift you up, whoa. Lift you up, whoa. Lift you up, whoa. Lift you up. Lift you up, whoa.
In the pre-chorus, right?
I was like,
"Mommy, stop crying! Mommy, stop crying! You're disturbing the peace."